on his camera phone.
Hey, Buzz.
He'd been taking the camera on his camera phone, and he'd been taking the picture of his room number in his telephone, on his hotel room.
Buzz.
So that when he got lost, and he came back to the hotel, and he couldn't remember which room he was in. Because when they give you a room key these days, the room key doesn't say you're in room 111 or 717 or something like that. So he would take the picture of the number on the hotel room. So it was another adaptation of technology. Huh?
My famous question is, who are you?
Buzz Bregman.
And why are we here?
Because I was talking to Bill earlier today. I showed him our software, and he was watching my little demo, and he said, "Did I know Doug Engel?" And I said, "Wow, only by reputation." And he said, "Well, you really should show your stuff to Doug." And I said, "When?" He said, "I don't know. Let's get Doug on the phone." So he had this Razor phone.
Yeah,
this fancy Motorola Razor phone, which didn't work very well. And we got Doug on the phone, and we invited him to dinner.
Well, it's a real honor, Doug, to meet you.
You guys have to stop that.
Well, this is what I do for Microsoft. I go around Microsoft and carry a camcorder, and I go into their offices, the people who build the products, and ask them stupid questions.
Robert had a wonderful day the other day with Gordon Bell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah, he gave me a 2-hour tour through the Computer History Museum. So,
well, you know, Doug was just inducted 2-3 weeks ago as a fellow there.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that, and I missed it. So.
Well, one of the things that you had told me, that you have like the second or third most popular video blog.
I don't know. We have 2.8 million visitors a month right now. So.
2 years.
To the Microsoft website.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was your own personal website.
Well, 85% of the videos are mine, so.
Okay.
Pretty close.
And how many people are reading your blog every day?
I don't know. I don't track it, so I don't know. 10,000, 20,000.
I mean, are there more than a million mentions of Robert Scoble on Google?
That's what it says. I don't believe it. And here's why I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Anyways. We should listen to Doug.
Well, part of this is because what you were doing, I thought was user interface stuff, and I thought and that's why I thought it would be a good meeting of the minds to bring them together.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my email address.
So Doug doesn't. I think Doug doesn't know anything about.
Okay. We'll take him through that idea.
Any of you, so.
All right, I'm going to turn this off so we can have dinner. Question.
Well, Doug, Robert has brought a couple of mice, shall we say, a covey of mice, a bevy of mice. What was the genesis of the idea?
It has two sort of branches that came together. One of them was I was having trouble getting any kind of support for my ideas at all. But then I noticed that people were beginning to do computer graphics. So it occurred to me that it would be handy to do some testing to see which of the current candidate for screen selection devices would go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been in the Navy and trained as an electronic technician to take care of radars. That's why I knew about light things and such. And other kinds of gadgets where they're available, I thought maybe I could just get some money to do some experimenting and get started at getting going in the interactive world. So, okay, we got a grant to do that research. And so we set up an experiment where a person, subject, would sit in front of a screen and at some random time, at some random location, a 3x3 array of different sized symbols would suddenly be there, and you'd have to hit the space bar, grab the access, the screen device, and go click on the middle one.
Mm-hmm.
And so there'd be various sizes, arbitrary places, etc. And so we were setting up that experiment, and we tried light pens and all kinds of gadgets. And I suddenly remembered something that I sketched during watching some early conference on graphics or something. And I like that. And it stretched something out that went right back to my time as a senior in electrical engineering in college, where we would do experiments on big kind of generators and so on, like the motors. And the data would come out sometimes in a sort of a funny shaped closed object. And what you had to do was figure out what was the area under that. Oh, so they introduced some gadget for us that we were supposed to use that would plump down in a solid base and have two arms and a pointer out here. And you're supposed to move the pointer around the surface, and you could tell. Well, how could you tell? Oh, there were two little wheels. One right there on the pointer was that way, like that. And another one over here on the elbow. And these wheels, you trace the circle. You read what those wheels said, and then you trace the circle and read what the wheels said, and do some kind of calculation, and it'll tell you what the area was. And I said to the teacher, well, that's really curious. They said, well, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it has to do with the fact that you put a wheel down with an axis or like that. And if you move it around like this, it's going to only show you the x-axis, mm-hmm. y-axis, or whatever. Put another one like this, I said, oh, that would show the other one. Oh, why don't we do that on a gadget like this with one sharp-edged wheel this way and the other this way? And so one of them, no matter how you move it, is going to show you just how far you move here. That sharp-edged axis. So I said, Bill, why don't we build this kind of a gadget and put it in the test? And it just happened to win all of them. I've got the original at home. It's about this big. Mm-hmm. And it's two wheels. And all each one of them did is a potentiometer that made me convert it to the computer where it was. And then it wasn't until many, many years later that human factors people were describing what it was about. Finger arm motion like this that made that be so good. I didn't know anything about that. So I just won the test. So I don't know. I can't brag too much about that.
One side effect of this, I always have fun telling the story because they were sharp wheels and X and Y. So these guys also, they have these special desks made. I mean, wood desks. And if you saw them initially, from the people using the mouse going forward and back, they cause ridges to form in the desk. So the little valleys on the X, Y axis. And then I remember that part. But then they start just using tablets of paper to do it on because it's easier to destroy paper than a desktop.
Well, cool. Thanks.
That's fun. So who came up with the name Mouse?
Oh, I... nobody knows, actually.
That's so bizarre.
There were maybe six or seven people involved. And people set up the experiment, the screen, the related. These things would appear there, and they had to do all the tests, and the computer would keep track of this. And the guy that had drafted the picture that was going to have to be built, and he happened to be one who said, I'm an amateur woodworking thing, I could build, carve a wooden case for a thing. So that's what they had, this kind of case like this. One button is all we needed, and one red button over here because the way the button would fit in the two wheels here. Mm-hmm. And the string, the cable came out the back. We didn't think about that would be more efficient to come up the other end. So you just see it sitting there like a one-eared mouse. So somebody started nicknaming it. And I'm not the kind of guy that gives it some official name at all. So pretty soon it became called the mouse, and no one can remember. Literally, no one can remember.
Now, do you agree with the people who like multiple buttons on the mouse, or do you think there should be only one button on the mouse?
Oh, no. Somebody said, how did you decide three buttons were on our mice? That's all I could get on.
So the more buttons, the better?
Yeah, no kidding.
The hardware team will be really happy with that. Because they, how many buttons do these things have? I don't know. Let's see, one, two, and the wheel is a button.
Yeah,
like, three, four, five. Yeah.
So when you saw the first commercial implementation of this, what did you say? Well, now people get it, or now?
That was 20 years later.
20 years later.
Because in 1963 we did these experiments.
So 1984, Microsoft rolls out the Macintosh, and you...
Xerox. You're rewriting history here.
The first commercial, successful commercial implementation of that. But when 1984 comes, and Apple does the 1984 commercial, just at the Super Bowl, and you saw this all roll out, what did you think then?
Inevitable. By then it was pretty clear that that was getting accepted. Mm-hmm. But so what? That wasn't any great big part of my ego. The thing I was, how do you get more focus on capability and get more capable about having interactive computer systems? We built a very... We had client-server time-sharing thing going in the late 60s. And so when everybody started talking about personal computers, and I would just say, hey, look, I'm interested in personal computing and what we can do with this very, very minimized client and time-sharing system over a modem. It started out at 1200 baud and then slowly gone up. It's so much more than anybody's PC that you could build today. It wasn't until sometime in the mid-80s or something that you could come close. And I said, look, I'm interested in the capabilities you can get. You know, no competition. So go ahead and play with personal computers, but don't stop the research about what you can do when you have real computer servers. And especially the time-sharing one, that is that anybody who is remotely using any place in the country can do the early ARPANET modem for these super simple client systems. Hey, we can collaborate. Like, we call you up on the phone and say, the guy calls me up and says, hey, we're having trouble here learning how to kind of use this system like that. Oh, I see. Well, hey, okay, I'm ready, so share screen. So I'd start seeing what their screen is doing. And pretty soon I could say, okay, pass me the controls. I'll show you how. And we could actually give presentation to them. So we're doing that in the mid-70s. Where just all kinds of things. We had electronic mail in the early 70s. Spreadsheets, all kinds of stuff. There's just no way. And we had a command system that was like a verb noun vocabulary. And your tech support person could set your profile up so when you boot it up, you had a very, very simple vocabulary that you could learn pretty quickly. So the secretary, for instance, would come in and be within an hour, you have to do practical word processing for you. But then the vocabulary would just grow and grow and grow. And it's that extended vocabulary that people look at and say, oh my God. So we got up to things like, oh, there's an interesting verb you could add. Transpose. What does that mean? That means and change. So, okay. If you ever wanted to, you could say, I want to interchange these two chapters. You just go, how much cutting and pasting does that take to interchange? So you could do that for words, invisible strings, and paragraphs, and just all kinds of objects that get in there. And if at first you wanted a simple vocabulary, okay. But then you begin realizing, you see somebody else say, what's that? Well, you could have these different kind of noun options. Well, I want those. Okay, here's all it takes to learn how to implement. And it just grew and grew. Mm-hmm. Spreadsheets transposed two columns. Mm-hmm. So it was just bitterly agonizing when the office automation and the AI people, both of them, ashes. And the whole crown and glory of that was with the guy that really started DARPA's, in those days, ARPA, the computer, their office was a computer techniques office or something like that. He started that one that was doing the funding for programs like ours and also funded the early start of the ARPANET. And he was a guy who was heavily involved in AI and stuff. So he did a lot about helping me get started. And he wrote a paper called Man-Computer Symbiosis. And later on, I met some other guys from Boston area who just, they said, you know what, this guy is a friend of ours, look lighter day. Oh my God, he was giving money to those characters way out there in the Palo Alto area. Well, there aren't any computer programmers. I was talking about me. You know, that they just were lampooning him for putting money way out there. And we actually got a grant really cut out because the people from the, that is what's the medical research community, they sent a group out and they just really were very sensible and they really liked the kind of thing we were proposing doing. And they went back, but then finally they sit back and said, we have to turn down your proposal because what you're proposing doing is really taking some very advanced computer programming. And since you're way out there in the Palo Alto area where there aren't any advanced computer programmers to do the work, we can't justify things like that. Then in 1977, this guy Licklider came by and he had been brought back by DARPA for a few weeks of consulting to go talk to the current principal investigators of their research to just sort of talk to them about what they were doing and help assess how well it was all going. So we sat there and we could show them all kinds of stuff. We were already, we've been for 3 years supporting people as a business who wanted to start using this. And so any university or government agency that qualified for a DARPA-supported thing could start using it. So we actually had them participating in this self-evolution process. So I kept rather proud of it. I was telling him like this, and I said, if I actually hired a team of about 5 or 6 people to go out there and get tech support, which are called tech support, now we call them application support. And I said, I picked life, liberal arts, women, recent graduates from college to do this, not programmers or something. Mm-hmm. It's such a board, and I turned around like this, and he was looking at me like this. What's the matter? And he just told me, your system no damn good. Believed him. I said, what do you mean? If it was any goddamn good at all, it would be interacting with the user and finding out what the user didn't know and teaching it. You wouldn't need any of these silly girls out there. And he just believed it so much, he went off and canceled. So all my research dropped away and the whole lab collapsed in 1977. Unfortunately, we had this sort of business thing going, so we took it in the commercial world. But the commercial world wasn't ready for it, so after 8 years or something, they said, well, we can't justify upgrading the software. Sorry. But boy, we just had it start evolving. Anyway.
One of the customers that the group had was Mattel. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember this. But space was so tight down in Southern California that they had the augment workstation inside the women's restroom. You remember that? And somebody took a picture of it. They opened the women's restroom door, and there was the terminal and the mouse and keyboard. They just didn't have any room in their regular office.
Now, did you always live in Palo Alto or in this area, or did you move here? Or?
Oh, no, I grew up in Oregon.
Yeah, that's right. You told us that. What brought you to Palo Alto? What was the impulse to
come? Well, it just happened that you're graduating, you know, different kind of people come to you and try to recruit you to different places. So I'd actually signed up with General Electric to go to their labs back in the East Coast. Then a guy came from Ames Laboratory. Mm-hmm. And my last 6 or 8 months in the Navy training had been at Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. And this area was nice. Stanford, cheap, co-ed, and stuff like this. I was a bachelor, so somehow I impulsively signed up for this and cashed the other one off. So I moved down here in 1948. Silicon Valley, it was Apricot Valley.
Right? Yep. Right.
And it wasn't until years later, and then I met, who was the guy from Bell Labs that started the transistor thing?
Oh, Shockley.
Shockley, yeah. So he came up visiting, he stopped at SRI, and I ferried him around the area and stuff like that, so it was good to watch him come. And it just happened two of the students he was trying to get going here. What he was trying to get going here didn't seem to work, and so these two set up some kind of wild area going, and it happened until after cell transition. So I watched all that happen.
Yes. Andy Noyce is from Grinnell, Iowa. And he went to Grinnell College and actually got thrown out of Grinnell College for some stunts, and then got his way back into Grinnell, and then went from Grinnell to Columbia and met up with Noyce, and they formed
Fairchild?
Fairchild, no. Yeah, and they ended up living here. And but there's a Tom Wolfe in one of his wrote an extensive essay about Shockley and Noyce and how they got to Silicon Valley and how they developed things they did and stuff like that. And, you know, gifted, you know, talented, bright, hardworking, and lucky. You know?
I was never oriented at all about the commercial side, because the thing it was, if the human race doesn't learn how to really go after the potential for being collectively more knowledgeable, so collectively they can look at and find these complex problems, understand them enough to get organized with them, and then so that was my dominant thing. It still is, but it isn't something that has been sellable.
Yeah,
the collective thing. But you're saying it is. Anyway, and then there's a whole bunch of pictures about what this augmentation system is like. All the capabilities in the infrastructure are going to be influenced by bringing in and, quote, automating this part. Well, that's going to change what this one can do. Well, that needs something here. And it's just the whole infrastructure needs to be opened up for evolution. And so the best that you can do is facilitate that evolution.
Yeah.
And so here's what you can do about it. But the business world doesn't see it like that. Naturally, what's going to make money? That's the thing.
Sure.
And we know about that. Well, yeah, I know, but there are other things you can be doing that will facilitate the evolution. And one of them is just very definitely open source software. I'm sorry, Mike.
We're two Microsoft guys here saying
that. Then that raises an interesting question.
Well,
you know, open source provides opportunities for people who can't afford the licensing, so to speak.
That's not the important thing.
That's not important, either.
That's not the important part of it. Okay. It's how can the evolution go? And it's sort of like saying, how would your natural language evolve if it got all tied up in proprietary? Oops, you can't use that verb. I've got a patent. Mm-hmm. That'd be hopeless. And that's what it really is. It's really about is what are you getting the screens to do? What are you getting the system to do for you? Mm-hmm. And what are the terminology you use and the vocabulary you use to direct it, etc. Mm-hmm. And it's just cannot evolve in your natural language. And it's very much like it. And I just figure.
But then take a little company like ours. You know, I went out and I raised $1.6 million. And we built a product. You know, what should our rights be relative to a product, to an idea? You know, are those something that we should... Mitch Kaper routinely asks me, whenever I see him, if I would give him the source code so he could improve the Chandler PIM. You know, so that he can take Chandler and make it into an open source contact manager. And we've built some very clever ideas. But Mitch already has made a fortune. Should I not have, and should my investors not have the opportunity to make at least a, you know?
I don't know a simple answer for that. But I do know and am totally convinced that the evolution has got to be freer than that.
But how do we reward and incent those who take risks?
I hear what you're saying, and I say I don't know the answer. But the people that are working with open source, etc., keep on evolving.
There's a certain element of trust that comes into it, and I talk a lot of, you know, in my world, I talk a lot about consumer generated content and helping marketers understand how to embrace it and recognize that they can actually participate in the conversation without controlling it or overly controlling it. Mm-hmm. And there's a great example that I use, American Airlines. Their campaign slogan is, "We know why you fly," which by itself would be an incredibly patronizing statement. American Airlines knows why we fly. That's why they leave us, you know, stranded on the tarmac for 4 hours. They know why we fly. Uh-huh. That's why they starve us for 5 hours so we can be extra hungry when we reach our loved ones. Mm-hmm. But the fact is they turn that completely around. And so they allowed consumers to send in video, home video, of reasons why they fly. Mm-hmm. So in other words, don't tell me why I fly. Let me tell you why I fly. Mm-hmm. And so you saw beautiful moments of kids being with their grandparents. And they took their content and they actually made it into advertising. And they embraced that content. So I guess the point is, I mean, that's just one, that comes back to your point about with open source. Open source can be part of a bigger evolutionary process on one level. But to answer your point, I think it's about trust. You know, and there has to be an element as in, if I give you something, will you take advantage? Mm-hmm. And I can only hope that you won't, and that you'll give something.
Well, the business people will make a different kind
of
business on top of open, because if you can't make money on the code itself or the idea of the code, you can make money like Google does, right? Google uses all open source software to make its operating system and its network. And they build an advertising system on top of it.
You could argue the whole evolutionary process of business innovation is actually happening as well with Google and as he's talking about. So we have software innovation happening evolutionarily with open source software, which is causing business innovation to happen at the same time.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, it's certainly
progress for everybody.
Even Microsoft is the Office file formats later this month are going to be opened up to open source. So, and that's a. You know, it's changing. Even the business people see that, hey, we got to go and, you know, open up things that used to be closed to make the systems go forward.
I'll give you a very interesting example. This is something that that Pete Blackshaw actually alerted me to today. TypePad has had incredible problems in the last few weeks, real growing pains. They sent around an email today basically saying, look, we've had terrible problems, we acknowledge it, and we acknowledge the fact that time is money. And your time and your lack of productivity and your frustration translates into money. What they did, which is unprecedented, is they gave their users a choice. They gave 4 or 5 choices. How much of a problem, how much of a loss of productivity did this cause you? And they basically said, no loss, some loss, you know, tremendous loss. And based on that level of loss, they said you would get 15 days of comp service, 30 days of comp service, 60 days of comp service, or no thank you, it didn't cause me any loss at all, I don't need any comp service. What an amazing turnaround, where they're basically putting the ball completely in the court of their consumers, saying, we're giving you the full choice, we're giving you the full spectrum, and you come back to us and you tell us, and we will honor that and we will trust you. That's savvy marketing. And of course, coming from TypePad, it would have to be because of who their consumers are. But that shows you how the world has changed. I think that's tremendous, don't you?
Yep. Well, it's been quite fun. I'll shut off the camera now and we can go and have some more conversation.
We can tell the truth.
We can tell the truth. Well, engineers always tell the truth. That's why I love talking to engineers. In fact, that's the whole point of my video, is to get right to the engineer's office and get the truth. Because they always tell you the truth, whether something works or whether it doesn't. Thanks.